Here it comes, the latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest, our very first broadcast of this particular kind this year in 2012. And I will tell you this, it's a truly incredible show that we have lined up tonight. We have in studio with us Thomas McDonald, and I have to read a lot of this because there are a lot of titles going on here with our three guests. He is the Projects Events Coordinator for the Institute of the Environment and the University of Arizona's Renewable Energy Network. Correct, Thomas? I got that right?
You got it right, yes.
Okay, so far so good. And in the first half hour, we'll be joined by Vernon Masayevsva, and he is a member of the Coyote Clan of the Hopi Tribe in northern Arizona and is very much involved in efforts of stopping the use of pristine N aquifer water to slurry coal from Black Mesa Mine to Laughlin, Nevada. And later, Perry Charlie, a U of A alumnus and director of the Uranium Education Program and Research and Outreach Director of, and I hope I say this right, and when Perry comes on, I will ask him, I think it is Dine, Environmental Institute of Dine College in Shiprock, New Mexico. And I spoke with him earlier today, and he is right at the very, very entrance to Canyon de Chelly, which I truly believe is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. So we have a great deal of information to go over in 1 hour. So let's get right to the guests. And Thomas, why don't we start with you? Thank you for being here to help me with this interview. Why are you here, and what's coming up this Thursday at the University of Arizona that we are, it's really the purpose of doing the show, to create some excitement about what's going on there?
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. This Thursday, February 23rd, starting at 3 p.m. in the Crowder Hall of the Music Building, we are hosting two films and two panels to sort of talk about some issues that are critical to Arizona and impact all of us, and especially our indigenous neighbors up in the Navajo and Hopi Nations. The goal of these events is to bring together the public, the U of A community of faculty and students, Navajo, Hopi, and Hopi environmental leaders, to sort of broaden our understanding regarding energy production, how it affects us all, and it shapes decision-making for Arizona and the Southwest as we move forward. So that is sort of why I'm here. Energy is starting to be at the forefront of the American public's mind.
Every conversation.
Exactly.
Absolutely and positively right. Mm-hmm.
And it's the choices we make going forward that will truly affect our decisions and the environment and our, you know, our personal environment and the environment as a whole. And so that's why these films are so important to sort of show now, because one thing that I think that many people don't realize and they don't think about is when you flip on the light, where does it start? You flip on the light and you know, maybe you think about the wires in your house and then the wire out to the telephone pole outside, and then you kind of just sort of stop and say, well, that's where energy comes from. It comes from the wire. And you don't think about where it begins.
And it's a great conversation to have. And I know both Vernon and Perry will be able to weigh in on this. I think before the birth of Mrs. Green, I just know I wanted my lights to go on. And now I'm very conscious of how much energy I'm using and where it's coming from. And also what some of the challenges are in terms of replacing coal. There's not a silver bullet yet, but we're moving to me, a more sustainable direction. So we'll go on to the experts. And I think that it would be great if you told our listeners how to get to a website or to your Facebook page to get more information, because you don't just want the community of the University of Arizona. We really want the public in Tucson and the surrounding areas to come and listen to these great speakers and to be participants in the panel and watch these two great films that are award-winning. I mean, they've won numerous awards. It's like they're not just late to the party. They were maybe before their time, but incredibly powerful right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you would like to go on the web, you can go to www.portal.environment.arizona.edu. edu. It's a bit of a mouthful.
I said there was going to be a lot of those long things.
Yes,
right,
exactly.
Now.
But from there, you can go see all of our events and the events coming up.
You have a lot coming up.
We do.
I spent a lot of time there this past couple of days. And I think it's also good to mention that you can always go to info@MrsGreensWorld, and we are happy to connect the dots for people. I'll certainly be putting it on my Facebook page. I will be there. I plan to show up at 3 o'clock, and I want to meet these two incredible gentlemen that I'm about to interview, because it's been fun just talking to them this afternoon and this morning. Okay, so let's start with Vernon. We have him on the line. And Vernon, I so made a commitment that I would absolutely and positively pronounce your name right. It's Masayevsna. Is that true? Yes, Masayevsna. Tell me.
Yep.
Okay, good. Thank you.
You said it beautifully. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I just want to do a little intro of you, because I think that's really important to kind of give our listeners a little bit of background. You are a member of the Coyote clan of the Hopi tribe in northern Arizona. You're from the village of, is it Hota Villa?
Yep, Hotvilla.
Hotvilla on the third mesa, one of the fingers of Black Mesa, which overlies what is possibly one of the nation's richest coal deposits. So you have a lot of background. You were the tribal chairman and the director of the Black Mesa Trust. I mean, it goes on. And one of your focus right now is you're dedicating your efforts to stopping the use of pristine and aquifer water, the sole source of drinking water for the Hopi people, to slurry coal from Black Mesa to Mojave Generating Station, Laughlin, Nevada. So we're going to have a lot to talk about tonight in this first part of the show. So thank you for being here. So why don't we start off with the view from 30,000 feet and have you share with us what you think are the energy issues surrounding energy production in northern Arizona. Why this, why now for you?
Well, first of all, in December 31st, 2005, we're able to shut down the coal slurry operation, which was bringing water from an aquifer, which is very ancient fossil water. That water was used to slurry pulverized coal to Mojave Generating Station. We were able to end that project, and so Mojave Generating Station is now permanently shut down.
Which is unbelievable.
On Laughlin, Nevada, 273 miles from Hopi Reservation. It's no longer in operation. It permanently shut down, so we were able to shut down the coal slurry operation. But the mining is still going on. It's still using water. Enough water. Let me rephrase it. Right now, the mining operation is still, Peabody operation is still using water.
Right.
Three times what entire Hopi reservation uses. So it's still there. It's still a problem. You know, the coal slurry was just incredibly amount of water. But now we are down to a less amount, but still using a lot more than the entire Hopi population. So what we want to do is end the mining, coal mining. That's what we're doing now as Black Mesa Trust. We want to save our water for future generations.
So, Vernon, yeah. I have to ask this to just give a little bit of background, okay, because I need to know about this. It's my understanding that in so many of the cases that I read about, What about about being a sovereign nation? How did it happen in the first place that the mining company was able to come in and mine on your land? Where that goes back way beyond, was it like 30 or 40 years ago? How did it happen in the first place?
I don't know. I have enough time to explain everything. But
I know. I said a half-hour show. I got to do an hour-and-a-half show.
Yeah, well, let's just answer the question. Who got us into this situation? The Hopi Navajo.
Thanks for putting it that way. The Hopi Navajo. Right. Okay. And I didn't know the answer.
The answer is simple. United States Congress.
Okay.
And the Secretary of Interior.
And said it was all going to be fine?
And attorneys for the Hopi tribe.
Ooh,
those are the players that got us into this situation for one purpose, most important purpose, is to bring water from Colorado River to Central and Southern Arizona.
Oh my gosh, you
Maricopa
are kidding.
And Pima County. That was the purpose. And these are the players that took advantage of the coal under our land and water under our land. And they exploited it. For example, the United States Secretary of Interior, who is our trustee, in order to provide an economic incentive for power companies to build Navajo Generating Station.
Right.
And Mojave Generating Station.
Right.
Approved the sale of our fossil non-renewable water for $1.67 per acre foot.
Oh my gosh. It's like this.
1 acre foot is 326,000 gallons.
Oh my God. It's actually nauseating to tell.
And coal was sold at one third the price of the going rate of coal mined on federal public lands.
So there you I had no idea that it was about water. I mean, people are saying in many, many well-respected arenas that the wars of the future are going to be fought over water rights, and there's a lot of evidence to support that, and look who's buying up water rights. I had no idea, Vernon, that that was at the back end of this. I really didn't. I'm not surprised that it was about a really good cost and a really great little profit there, but it is very shocking to me. So what's the film about, Power Pass, that we'll be showing? I mean, it's about the global energy crisis, but does it talk about the intertribal coalition, and can you tell us about that and what the film is about? Because I think that's important. We really want to get people there to help them get educated about what's going on.
Well, to operate a giant thermal electric plant, like Navajo Generating Station.
Right.
You need a lot of water.
Right.
And you need a lot of coal to create steam. And so we, Hopi and Navajo tribe, you know, gave up all the water and the coal. So power can be generated to feel the pumps that bring water to Tucson. We're subsidizing the water users here in Tucson.
That's just another shocker.
People don't know about that. And so what we're saying is that we can continue to provide water for Phoenix, Tucson, without using coal. We can transition Navajo Generating Station away from using coal and then transition into using cleaner energy sources
So actually replace the coal mines with power plants with renewable energy technology.
Exactly.
So what are your top picks for some of the renewable energy technologies?
Well, we're talking, for example, about hydroelectric power.
Okay, unbelievable.
There are a lot of power dams were built by the federal government, paid for by the taxpayers,
right,
to provide electricity.
Right.
And none of that power is currently dedicated to running Central Arizona Project pumps. And so we're saying, why don't we revisit that and maybe dedicate some of that hydroelectric power to fuel the pumps for Central Arizona Project. And then add to that solar power, which is abundant in Arizona.
Right, in the entire Southwest. It is definitely a renewable energy source. Today was a great example.
And the third source would be natural gas. Now, natural gas is controversial. You know, people don't like that. But still, it's cleaner. It burns cleaner than coal. So if we can put our minds and our will, including the political will, to transition Navajo Generating Station away from coal.
It can move it all far. Right.
That plant can continue to supply power to Phoenix and Tucson at affordable rates. That is doable.
So I want to ask about what type of impact has the agreement and the taking the water out of your community and bringing it to far away places and transporting it? Because, I mean, to transport water, there's certainly an energy use involved in the transportation of water because it has to be pumped uphill. What is the impact on your communities that are actually the source of the power? What type of impact? Is it getting worse? What are you seeing? How quickly do we have to move this thing forward?
Well, thankfully, the slurry operation has ended.
Right, right.
And before that ended, about 1.2 billion, I think it was 1.2 billion acre feet of water was being pumped out of the desert, and the water that's non-renewable. Now, if you want to know if you want to have a sense of how big this is, look at Rio Salado Lake in Tempe.
Right.
That's under a billion gallons of renewable water in that lake.
So that's kind of like a puddle compared to what this was being pumped out.
So when you talk about putting out 1.2 billion gallons of water from a non-renewable water, fossil water, pure water, every year, it kind of gives you a perspective
of
how much water we have given up over the last 35 years.
Yeah.
And it's still continuing. It's the slurry has ended, but the mining is continuing, using about 1.5 acre feet of water, which is about three times what the entire Hopi Reservation is using.
I mean, it's a big number. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to explain something to me because the only thing that I know about the word slurry is that it's something they drop from airplanes when there are forest fires. So I don't understand, and I'm sure most of the listeners don't understand that process when you say to slurry coal from one place to another. I'm sure you do. So can you explain it for John Q. Public like me?
Yeah. What the mining company does is dig up the coal.
Right.
And digging up the coal is done through strip mining, which is another story.
It's another radio show. Yes,
destructive.
It is.
You know, and then they grind up that coal, and then they mix it with water.
Okay.
Pristine water. So it's like half-half. Ratio is half-half. Half coal, half water.
Right.
Then they push it to a huge pipeline from our land up to Laughlin, Nevada, 273 miles. And when it reaches its destination, then they put it into like a spin cycle in your washing machine. And the water is spinned out. And
it turns back into coal?
Wet coal is then used to fire the generators. That's what coal's... And the coal slurry operation was engineered by Bechtel Corporation. And they have a patent on it.
And that process.
And so when this is tested out and it works, they're going to sell it to China or Russia or somewhere.
Okay,
So that's how this came about. And so, you know, every day as you breathe, 50 gallons of water is being used to push the coal to Laughlin, Nevada. Every minute, 50 gallons a minute as you sleep.
Yeah, it's
24 hours a day.
24 hours a day. And I want to ask you this. Do most power companies use that same process of the slurry
Nobody
coal?
Nobody does.
Okay.
This was the only one of its kind in the
world.
I
never heard of it. I mean, I really never heard of it. And I thought I knew a lot about power plants. So tell me, let's go back to the, what does the film tell us? What is the film about and why should people come and make sure they see it? I know I'm going to come to hear you and Perry because it's been thoroughly enjoyable talking to you. But what is the film Power Pass about and how did it come to be?
Well, we don't need coal-fired plants to, you know, sustain our way of living. I mean, it's gonna cost more, but certainly we can, in Arizona particularly, which to me is the solar capital of
the world. I couldn't agree with you more.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
And Governor Napolitano was correct when she said one day's solar power will generate all of our electrical needs. Meet all our electrical needs. And she's correct. So there is the source. There is the technology. But there is no political will. The Salt River Project, owners of Neville Generating Station, they want to milk it dry. You know, they don't want to lose that plant, because building a coal-fired plant today is almost next to impossible. So they want to hang on to this good deal that they've been now enjoying for over 40 years at our expense.
And
you know, they don't want that change, and they got all the political support behind them. Hopis and Navajos don't.
Do you think that things like this, like having an event like this and having you talking about it on, you know, a national radio broadcast, do you think that people, do you see hope for people like me caring more and getting the word out more, and for the consumer to realize, starting to realize that what happens in northern Arizona and the pollution from the coal powered plants affect me. It's air I breathe. It's air they breathe all the way. You know, they can track it around the world in a certain cycle. Do you have hope, or have you been doing this for so long that it's like, okay, when are people going to wake up? Are we picking up steam, so to speak?
Well, you know, the people are you know, they're very, we're all very, we're human beings. We all have feelings and, you know, concerns and sympathy. But if you don't know where your electricity is coming
comes from
and
right.
at whose expense, they're not going to get too terribly concerned as long as you switch the light.
And the
light comes on. It's just like flushing a toilet.
I know. You know, that's one of my favorite subjects. I have all high efficiency toilets in my house. I felt I was having guilt. Now I have guilt free flushing because I use like 1.2 gallons instead of 3 gallons. So that's one of the things that I think is important. And we are getting almost to the midway point, and we're going to have to get Perry on the line. But one of the things that you and I talked about, and we've had a couple of delightful conversations, and you asked me to talk about, and I loved it. I did. I lit up. It may not be related to the energy issue that is front and center, but you would like to talk a little bit about the end of the Mayan calendar. In December, it certainly is a very big. It's a big topic, and I certainly don't believe it's going to be the end of the world. But what's happening in the Hopi world about, you know, what's your perspective and that of your nation on the tribal calendar? I mean, on the Mayan calendar.
Well, first of all, Hopis are descendants of the Toltecs and the Mayans.
Okay.
That's where we came from. We call it the underworld. We come from underworld to the upper world. The upper world is the fourth world of the Hopi. And we have a prophecy, which is written on a rock near my house, of what could happen. And the prophecy is not saying this is going to happen.
Right.
The prophecy says this will happen if you allow it to happen.
Okay.
So to the Hopi, we are now at the end of the fourth world. We've been through three worlds. We are living in the fourth world, and we are at the end of the fourth world. Now, will there be a fifth world? The Hopi say that really is up to us. But there's one thing we can't get away with. We can't buy our way out of the suffering that we have to go through because we have abused Mother Earth.
We have abused Mother Earth.
We have abused Mother Earth, and there has to be punishment. And punishment in Hopi is purification. So the Hopi is saying we are in the era of the great purification, which then coincides with the ending of the Mayan calendar, which is this year, December 22nd, when the sun sets down. And this Mayan calendar is over 5,000 years old.
I know.
And
December 22nd is right.
Yeah. Okay. And many people are there are speculators out there who are saying the world's going to end. Some say nothing's going to end. And some say we are going to move into a different level of consciousness.
And I'm going with that one. I can tell you that right now. I mean, I say that very sincerely and not in any way trying to be flip. I'm actually honored that you shared that with me and with our audience, and that it will be living on a podcast for other people to hear what you had to say. And I very much look forward to meeting you on Thursday. You can be certain I'll come up and shake your hand and be at your presentation.
Okay.
So thank you so much for being a part of Down to Earth with Mrs. Green for the first broadcast in 2012. And I hope our paths cross many times.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so
much.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. Okay, if you just tuned into the broadcast or clicked in, that was Vernon Masayevsva, who is a member of the Coyote Clan of the Hopi Tribe in Northern Arizona. Thomas, wasn't that great?
That was incredible.
Oh my gosh, he is a storyteller.
Yes, indeed.
He really is a storyteller. So I am honored that he shared that. And I very much read a lot about the Mayan calendar and about that date, and I did not know that the Hopis were descendants. Is that something that you knew?
I didn't. And, you know, you so often hear just sort of the movie version, you know, essentially, oh, it's December 22nd, the world's going to end, and you expect, you know, John Cusack to fly in his plane over a world that's just crashing apart.
Right.
And, you know, not very many people think about the fact that it's something meaningful to a lot of people.
It is. It's very meaningful. And there's a lot of changes that are going on right now anyway. So we are talking to Thomas McDonald, who's the project's events coordinator for the Institute of the Environment and the U of A Renewable Energy Network at the University of Arizona. And we are doing this broadcast because of Thursday's events. So tell us a little bit about those again.
Sure. On Thursday, we'd like your listeners to join us at the University of Arizona starting at 3 p.m. at Crowder Hall in the U of A Music Building to see a screening of The Return of Navajo Boy. It's followed by a panel at which Vernon and Perry will be a part of. And then we'll have an hour break. This will go until 5 p.m. We'll have an hour break. And then we'll a short walk over to the Center for Creative Photography, which is right next door. Starting at 6 p.m., we will screen another movie called Power Paths. And we'll have another panel discussion, which will discuss sort of power paths and the, you know, sort of coal and that sort of thing. And each film will have a full panel of U of A faculty. We'll have Navajo and Hopi environmental leaders. And we hope that you'll join us to sort of take an active role in how energy production affects you going forward.
All of us.
Yes.
All of us forever. So I love what Vernon had to say. And we are now going to interview Perry Charlie, who has another. I've got to read a little bit about you, Perry. Thank you so much for being on the show. And you have a long title. You're doing a lot, and I want to make sure that I say it right. First of all, you're a wildcat, which I really like. I didn't bring up that Vernon was a went to ASU because this is a friendly show. So thank you for being with us tonight. And you are the director of Uranium Education Program and the research and outreach director of the did I have it right? Dene?
Yes.
Okay.
Environmental Institute.
Yes. Environment Institute. Of Dene College in Shiprock, New Mexico. And I did announce on the show earlier that you're right at the entrance to Canyon de Chelly, which I think is truly one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And I actually got to go there for the very first time when with my husband and his family. I'm from New Jersey, so you can imagine a Jersey girl going to Canyon de Chelly and seeing all of the wonder that you can't describe on a radio show. So thank you for being on the show, and I have lots of questions for you. So I think we should just get on with that, okay?
Okay.
You are the uranium guy. I mean, I read so much about you, and you have such a broad and diverse background. Can you just give us some of the abbreviated version of why you ended up focusing on this and why you're the major issues that you're involved with right now, so people get some type of a vision for the scope of who Perry Charlie is.
Okay. As mentioned, I'm currently living in Chinle, Arizona. I continue to be with the Chinle Wildcats. So,
that's great. Oh, my gosh, that's great. So, yeah, all right, that's really good. There's a game.
And it's a Wildcat.
Okay.
My career as a nuclear scientist started years ago in the late 1960s when I was a boarding school student. When I returned one summer, I found something very disturbing, and that was my dad. He had moved most of his stuff, his personal belongings, out of a house that he had built. And he had moved into a temporary shelter. It's called an offer brush shelter. And one of the things that happens in Navajo families is when they know that they are approaching the final stages of their life, rather than condemn a family dwelling, they elect to move out. And that's what happened to my my father. And I asked my mom what was going on, and she told me that I needed to talk to Dad. And that led me on a long course. I wanted to know what happened, why my dad was sick, why he's mining in the uranium mines in the tune of about 27 years, and his exposure from the radiation.
Right, right.
What happened, what was it, and how? It started me on a long process. I went back to school, and I have over 40 years of professional experience dealing with the impact of the Manhattan Engineering District and the Atomic Energy Commission of the 1940s to 1960s. And I've done much work related to that.
So I watched quite a few clips that I could find about the return of the Navajo boy. It is a very, very well done film. It's won numerous awards. I had never heard of it until Thomas contacted me about the events on Thursday, as I'm sure hundreds of millions of people have not heard of it, but hopefully thousands of them more will have because of the show and what the Institute of the Environment is doing. So how did someone get enough attention to make the film Return of the Navajo Boy?
Well, my friend Jeff Spitz out of Chicago, Illinois, was the one that initially approached. It actually happened quite contrary to looking at the impacts of uranium. It just happened as a part of the documentary.
Okay.
He was more interested in a documentary that he got from a gentleman by the name of Kennedy. He had a solid movie, and he wanted to view parts of it. The gentleman, Mr. Kennedy, gave a copy of it to Jeff so that he can review it.
Okay.
He knew there were a lot of culturally sensitive issues in there.
Okay.
That's how I got involved. I was a mine reclamation manager and the director at that time. So, and we were working in Monument Valley, and the family who participated in that silent movie of the early 1900s. They had grown up. They didn't know that they were still alive. And Jeff took a journey to the Navajo Nation, the heart of the Monument Valley area.
Okay.
To try to look for these individuals who were part of the movie itself. So one thing led to another. And in the movie, there was a very conspicuous white street running down the sheer cliffs, the red sand cliffs. And he wanted to know what it was. And we were doing work up there, reclaiming abandoned uranium mines at that time. And the white cliff, the white stain was actually radioactive in nature.
Oh,
it was coming off the mountainside. And that's how I got involved in the documentary. So the shift from looking at the family and the contents of the silent movie drastically turned, and he was able to document how one single family were impacted by this thing called K'Thoth and Navajo uranium, and what radiation did to the family. And there was other components like the separation of a small 2-year-old child from the family, and to this day, he continues to live outside of the immediate family. They lost contact with that. So the sad legacy of a family that was separated at childbirth because of the death of a mother from lung cancer occurred also. All these components are in the movie itself. So uranium mining, the reclamation of those mines, and the compensation of uranium miners on the Navajo reservation as well as off the reservation are all detailed in the film documentary.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me is that, the film, it was produced, the premiere was in 2000, which is a decade ago, a decade plus two. And did it help raise awareness that at that point, and in what ways, and what do you hope to, you know, to me, it's like I feel like I was asleep in 2000. I didn't realize that the earth is a sealed envelope. And the film, I spent all afternoon just watching more clips and more clips and reading more about it. And I know that other listeners will care a lot, but in 2000, it won awards, but what type of impact did it have? Did it start planting the seeds to raise the awareness?
The film started doing that, yes. It was able to enlighten the general public at first about some of the serious environmental and public health impacts that the indigenous community of the Navajo Nation had to endure because of the legacy. It showed the gross inadequacy and the cultural insensitivity of a compassionate program that dealt with the payment of radiation victims. There were many aspects that were, for an example, in the Navajo world, there is a legitimate marriage that is consummated through ceremonies and through the guidance of a traditional practitioner. Now, the United States government failed to recognize that. In fact, it wanted a lot of these traditional ceremonies to be conducted on paper and documented on paper. So the uranium miners and their families had a hard time dealing with that.
Right.
The very agency who also adamantly opposed the establishment of the compensation program, the United States Department of Justice, was also entrusted to administer the program. And you can see the horror story. They were very, very critical, requiring certified and contemporaneous records for uranium miners to show that they had been exposed to anomalous levels of radiation in their employment years. It also shows on the in the film documentary the sheer number of uranium mines that that impacted the Navajo families, and literally the entire 27,000 square miles of Navajo Nation is covered with abandoned uranium mines. It was so large in scale that it required four mill processing sites, one in Shiprock, New Mexico, not far from where I live, one in Mexican Hat, one in Monument Valley, and one in Tuba City, Arizona. It just shows just how detailed and how wide dispersed the uranium mining.
Right, what a vast area that it covers, right.
Right. And the inadequacy of the law that allowed us to reclaim these mines. We were using coal revenues and coal royalty shares. There was no federal department or program that would fund reclamation of abandoned uranium mines in place. So our reclamation activities was very limited, and it left behind tons of radioactive debris, as the movie shows. And the impact continues to the public health, to the air, to the land, and to our water resources. I spent many, many years sampling and conducting water quality studies on the reservation. I've seen tremendous amount of our precious water sources being continue to be impacted out here in the mine areas.
And it's interesting to me, I can't help but to make this analogy. I mean, one of the most compelling films and game changers in our lifetime was Erin Brockovich. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. They were taking, that little stick of dynamite, was taking on a major, you know, utility company, and that certainly raised awareness. And it seems to me like there are some similarities in terms of the, you know, the big corporate giant just coming in and doing whatever they want and then leaving. I have to ask
That's
you this
right.
though: is there a safe way to mine uranium, because I've had guests on the show that are monitoring the Gulf, you know, the BP oil spill, and they have said, they are scientists, and they say there is a safe way to extract oil, but the oil companies don't want to spend the money on what it would take because it'll affect earnings per share. So Perry, is there a safe way to mine uranium that doesn't put the population at risk and is a danger to people and therefore the planet?
I have yet to encounter any methodologies, any technique that is currently available throughout the United States and for that matter throughout the world that would show, you know, the mining methods are right now safe and practical.
Okay.
Once you get the uranium ore out, people and the environment are going to be exposed to levels of radiological contaminants in the air, in the water, in the lands, through our food sources, and certainly into the public, especially the industry workers. It's been lauded that the in-situ leach mining is by far the safest. I doubt it. There's a lot of unknowns in the subsurface, our water reserve, there's fractures inside, deep inside the geological layers we're not aware of. There may be underground reserves that of other types of mineral reserve that may be affecting, that may be compounded. And what do you do once you take the ore reserve out in liquid format? How do you address and get the water body back to its natural state? All those things are detrimental to environmental and public health. So I have yet, in the 40-plus years of study that I have done, I don't think I have ever seen any safe methods that can be employed in uranium mining.
Well, one of the things that I noticed in your bio that very much interested me is you've done work on the psychosocial impact from past nuclear industries on the Navajo lands. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I would think that is a ripple effect, a pebble in the pond. So what has been some of your experience with the psychosocial impacts from all of this really horrific mining and you know, resultant health issues and death and cancer and, you know, on and on and on.
Right. The objective of that study that I was a cool PI on the university was that we wanted to look at the widows and their surviving families, the children. We wanted to know what they thought of, what were the reactions towards the industry itself, who arbitrarily allowed their fathers, their uncles, their grandfathers, and their brothers into the mines, knowing as early as 1947, 49,
oh my gosh,
that they were certainly will be exposed to high levels of radon progenies, and that they were retained as a guinea pig study, and that they were actually on a deathbed watch type of experimentation. And it was done by the very agency who is entrusted today, the Indian Health Service, to conduct that study. And it was sanctioned and approved by the U.S. Surgeon General. What are their thoughts about it? How did they continue to live with the consequences?
Right.
The small community in Arizona, in northeast Arizona, is called Cove, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
It's a community that is known by the sad legacy that only widows live in that small community, a community of about 3,000 people. It was heavily mined. There's over 235 mines in that area, abandoned uranium mines.
235? Okay.
Right. And I dare say that probably a good 90-95% of the uranium miners are now gone. And so the community is filled with widows. So how did they look at the mining companies? how do they perceive the U.S. government, who has failed to adequately provide public health, environmental health, and a form of compassionate program that is far less compassionate than what it was originally intended for. So I know of young men who were probably in high school, and because the family, the primary source of employment, the father or the brother, may have been deceased because of mining activities, they had to drop out of school. Are their lives different? Those are some of the psychological and psychosocial impact that the families have to endure. The family that is featured in The Return of the Navajo Boy, you see how a family was finally reunited towards the end, the brother and the sisters and some of the other brothers. But even to this day, John Wayne Cly cannot, he doesn't feel comfortable moving back into Monument Valley because he's been so far away from his Navajo family. He's lost contact. He's lost his tribal identity.
Right.
Those are some of the cultural and the psychological impacts that resulted because of mining and milling on the Navajo reservation.
And it changed that him forever. I mean, he grew up in a family where he was adopted and not allowed to speak his language and not allowed to even speak of the culture. And when that comes at a very young age, he became the culture that he lived with. And it's to me personally quite tragic. What is, when you get up in the morning, this is really maybe a weird question, what are you trying to accomplish with what you're doing right now and your work in your role at the, you know, the Uranium Education Program? What are you working on that is highly topical for this day and will be talked about on Thursday?
I think number one is the educational component. The impact of uranium mining and milling has affected virtually every segment of Navajo life, and it reaches into our government. It also reaches into our language. We're comfortable. You and I can talk about a lot of nuclear terminology.
Right.
Beta,
right.
Yeah. But in the Navajo language, those are non-existent. We have yet to develop glossaries. I think that's my goal. I am one of the key individuals on the Navajo reservation. It's finally beginning to develop these technical terminologies from the in the English language back into the Navajo. So it has affected our language. And that plays a big role in community education and hence research and outreach. The other component is outreach. I want to see if even after the fact, 30, 40 years, 50 years, from the last mining era on the Navajo Reservation, that I want to demonstrate that the impacts are continuing, environmental impacts. Even before birth, and especially at birth, the Navajo people, the Dene people, are tied to the environment. We have our umbilical cord that is buried and back into our primary livelihood. Be it shepherd, be it rancher, those are continually placed and back into the environment. Our ties with the environment is very, very strong. We don't try to conquer the environment. We are a part of nature.
Right.
Everything has a place.
Right.
And we revere that. That's the Native American concept. And yet we have an insidious evil that is in our midst now. How do we conquer that? The Naye, the demons, the monsters that resulted from arbitrarily mining uranium on the Navajo reservation.
And
how do we handle?
And aren't there still areas where there is active radioactive waste on the reservation, on the lands that you're talking about? I mean, it's not like it's all disappeared from what I can read, or is everybody safe now? From what I understand, there are far, you know, reaching effects that continue on today. So feel free to correct me if that's not correct.
You are correct. Now, I spent 8 years of my professional life as a member of the National Academy of Sciences dealing with low-level radiation. And when we looked at, in some instances, high-level radiation. Now, it's interesting how the law, the Code of Federal Registry looks at radioactive waste. Radioactive waste associated with mining is merely considered as overburden, and it can be left scattered down mesas through mountains and eventually percolate down into the ground surface water reserves.
Do you mean literally like scattered? It can just be like...
Yeah.
Okay, that's kind of the cut thing that takes my breath away.
Right.
It's appalling.
The other thing, the other component is you take the same material into the mill processing site, and the tailings over there in the mill sites are considered as what the law refers to as 11E3 byproducts. It requires special administration, special handling, special disposal, long-term surveillance and maintenance of these disposal areas, and is considered high-level radiation, the same material that is still left on the mountaintops in and around the abandoned uranium mines. And we have tons of radioactive material that continue to degrade the environment and our communities out there. It's not just the Navajo Reservation. I have worked in Colorado. I'm going to be going back up there in a few weeks to do another series of lectures very similar to what I'm going to be doing this week. I have gone into the state of Utah. I have worked on the uranium mines and the Gas Hill districts in Wyoming. I still see the same thing. Very similar impact happened in non-Native communities. There's such an impact, and the growth inadequacies and deficiencies of our existing laws, things need to be done in that regard.
So let me ask you this, because believe it or not, we are going to run out of time, and that when I called you earlier today, I said I was going to do a half-hour show and that there was no way I could cover these important topics in an hour, let alone in giving each of you 15 minutes, so I decided to make the show an hour. I want to ask you about your personal view of hope. Do you feel that more people are waking up, that they're dedicating their efforts to becoming more active in stopping some of this or in regulating it? Just from when the film first came out, do you feel hope? And of course I want you to say yes, but I really want you to tell me the truth. We have about 2 minutes left.
Personally, I don't think so. I think we are finally reaching the peak of the sheer amount of cancer that is prevalent among the mining community. The government has failed time and time again to adequately address our plight. It's shows and documentaries and newspapers. LA Times was very good at doing that, to opening the doors for an investigation from Congress. But you're talking to a man who is also right now afflicted with a type of laryngeal cancer, and that's directly related to my 40-plus years of exposure. So,
I almost asked you that, Perry. I almost asked you that. How do you protect yourself? Because you've certainly... So there's the answer.
I'm a researcher, but yet I still came down with a form of cancer.
Okay, on that note, we are out of time, and the good news is that you'll be here on Thursday. I cannot wait to meet you. I'm honored that you're on the show. Any more information that you want, please contact info@MrsGreensWorld. Perry, thank you so much, and I will see you Thursday, and hopefully we will fill the house.
Ahead. We will all see you there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much also. You're listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green. Thank you, Thomas, for being here. Quite a moving show.
Yes, thank you very much.
Quite a moving show, and I'll see you Thursday. It's going to be a delightful, albeit somewhat painful, way to spend the day. Thanks for being here with us.